This Indonesian case has a lot to teach us, especially in how it speaks to this transition out of a politically polarized strongman regime, which I think connects to some of the main issues facing democracies around the world in the modern era.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, spending on infrastructure is expensive, but a new hospital, for example, it's good for the people who use it, and it's a vote winner for the government that delivers it. But is this democratic accountability always a force for good? In general, voters like the idea of better healthcare, but they really like the idea of better healthcare on their doorstep. And so the desire to win votes in some regions more than others may also distort the way that democratic decisions are made. Our paper today investigates this issue using a natural experiment, 1999's collapse of the Suharto regime in Indonesia and the free elections that followed. It provides both an insight into the impact of democracy in general on infrastructure spending, in this case on healthcare, and on the causal relationship between democracy and the way that spending is allocated. Alan Zhao of Princeton is the author. And he joins me now. Alan, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim. Wonderful to be here.
Alan, the first figure you quote in the paper really caught my attention. I imagine it's going to catch everyone's attention. You say that there's $2 trillion of global investment in infrastructure each year. That is a huge number. What does that cover?
You're exactly right that it's a big number. It turns out that this $2 trillion, the sort of biggest thing that it captures is electricity projects and roads, but also captures other public goods like schools, hospitals, water infrastructure. And it's, I think, crucial because it's an important driver of economic development. It's a driver because when it's allocated properly, it can have benefits for decades. But the issue here is just that these big infrastructure projects are often the targets of corruption in weak institution settings. And so in this paper, I'm studying how democratization can improve that allocation of these crucial resources.
As you said, when it is allocated properly. So in the absence of democracy, so there is a dictator who is deciding where to put infrastructure spending, someone like Suharto in the 20th century regime in Indonesia, how might that dictator decide where and how the money is spent?
So the concern here is just that a leader, especially a strongman leader, these kinds of leaders aren't necessarily accountable to voters. And so what they can do is they can allocate these resources as they see fit.
Yeah.
The problem is that what they value may not be what is actually good for society. It may just be beneficial to them privately. So for example, they may be directing services to their own supporters and focusing just on their own supporters instead of to all citizens equally. Democracy then can help fix this.
Yes, we do imagine that democracy fixes this because it creates this system of accountability. But when you vote, you don't vote for where every road and hospital is going to go. So how does this mechanism of accountability work through democracy?
Yes. So, Tim, you're exactly right that citizens don't get to vote on every single project that determines where public spending goes, but they do elect the leaders who are the ones who make these decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And importantly, when they go to the ballot box over the course of the election cycle, every 4, 5, 3 years, they can use their votes to hold these leaders accountable. And so if it's the case that these politicians want to be reelected or just elected in the first place, they need to listen to voters in some broad sense. That's the sense in which democracy can help to discipline a bit this kind of public spending.
There's another dimension to this as well that you examine in the paper, which is decentralization. If you have a strong leader, then there's one person effectively making all the big decisions. All the decisions are made at the center. Democracy often includes this idea that local politicians can make decisions as well. Now, I can imagine what you might say about how this improves the quality of decision making. Is there also maybe a way in which decision making could be made worse by this local accountability?
Absolutely. So when we're talking about local elections in particular, the issue is simply that these local elections ultimately end up reinforcing these kind of local political boundaries, which ultimately are artificial. Mm-hmm. So for example, local leaders may really just want to serve their local voters. Why? Because those local voters are the only ones who actually vote for them.
Yes.
And to the extent that these local leaders don't take into account, in the case of Indonesia, for example, benefits to other Indonesians who aren't in their own local constituency, then you'll have a distortion coming out of this local political setup.
It's the same all over the world, isn't it? You hear these stories about different states, different regions, different cities, effectively competing against each other for a limited set of resources. And that could potentially be a bad outcome of democracy.
That's exactly right. Person A and person B are both Indonesian citizens, but person A happens to live in a different district than person B does. Person A's political leader is only going to care about person A and not about person B, even though they should, if we're talking about society as a whole.
Presiden Republik Indonesia, masa bakti 1999 sampai 2004, ada yang terhormat, Saudara Abdurrahman Wahid.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu.
That's the moment in October 1999 when the first democratic elections in 54 years in Indonesia selected Abdurrahman Wahid, popularly known as Gus Dur, to be the president. His plan was to establish a national unity government that would improve conditions for Indonesians by promoting policymakers, as he claimed, based on ability, not on political ties.
The National Unity Cabinet will be based on three preconditions. First, the ministry should be an honest and simple living person. Second thing, they should know what to do. Third thing is that they are accepted by the society at large. So we don't base that on political affiliation, but on skill.
So, Alan, the elections in Indonesia in 1999, that's basically the point at which this whole story turns, isn't it? So for people that don't know the political history of Indonesia, why was this moment important? What change was happening?
So to provide a little bit of historical context here, there was a strong leader in place, the previous leader named Suharto, who had been in power at that point for 32 years. And the background leading up to 1999 was that in 1997, there was the Asian financial crisis. Indonesia was particularly hard hit. That led to a series of events that kind of catalyzed Suharto ultimately resigning from power in May of 1998. And so then the vice president, Habibie, took over as a transitional president, kicking off this period of reformation, which really kicked off essentially in 1999 with one, a political parties law, which opened the way for more political parties to take part in these elections. Mm-hmm. Previously, it was capped. Two, there's this regional autonomy law, which really devoted a lot of resources that had previously been centrally allocated from Jakarta out to the local governments. And then lastly, in 1999 as well, there were these legislative elections, the first free elections in Indonesia since, I believe, 1955.
So let's set the baseline for how good healthcare was when these elections were taking place. Before this wave of democratization and decentralization, how well or badly were those healthcare facilities allocated? And what would this mean to an ordinary citizen who was seeking healthcare at the time?
Part of what I do in the paper is to exactly measure this thing that you're asking about, this allocation, how well or how badly healthcare facilities were allocated. And so what I have is a measure of value for citizens, and I can look at what kind of value is created by the so-called optimal allocation, the thing that makes that value as big as it possibly can be. Mm-hmm. And I can make statements like, for example, relative to that maximum value, the facilities that were actually allocated, that were actually built, only kind of lived up to about 60% of that total maximum value. And this is important for ordinary citizens because it simply means that ordinary citizens needed to travel farther to access these healthcare services. It's important then because at that point, the average distance to the nearest public hospital for a given person was about 30 kilometers, not a small distance. Mm. And so the allocating these facilities to where they really need to go can have a big impact. It's not as if Indonesia was swimming in hospitals to begin with.
And how rigorously can you estimate this? This strikes me as a very difficult estimation to make, what the optimum allocation of healthcare might be.
Absolutely. So to kind of get some traction on this, I estimate what's called a spatial demand system. Mm-hmm. In terms of the data that I have, basically what I have is as follows. I know where these new facilities are being opened up over time, and I also know what kinds of facilities people are using over time. And so I can use this kind of staggered rollout of new facilities to intuitively get at the following relationship. If it's the case that a new, closer facility opens, how much more do people now use that facility? That helps me to think about the kind of disutility of distance. Or the other side of the coin is how much people value having close facilities. That valuation is what I'm talking about when I talk about the sort of maximum value created by a given budget of healthcare facilities.
So then we have these elections. How big an investment that triggers in new healthcare facilities?
Yes, the post-democratization investment was definitely substantial. And it was enough to drop those average distances that I mentioned to kind of the nearest healthcare facilities by quite a lot. So for distance to the closest public hospital, for example, the pre-democratization number was 30 kilometers that I mentioned earlier. 10 years later after democratization, it dropped down to 20 kilometers. For public clinics, these numbers went from 6 kilometers all the way down to 4. And for public kind of sub-clinics, small supporting clinics, from 3 kilometers down to 2. So the amount of investment in healthcare infrastructure in Indonesia was substantial over this time.
And you're using the same techniques here to estimate how optimal that allocation is, because also you're looking at the local democracy here. So I guess there's a level of looking at how optimal those local plans translate into healthcare for every Indonesian.
That's exactly right. I can use exactly the same techniques that I used to think about the optimality of the pre-democratization allocation to think about the post-democratization allocation. It's the same exercise. I can use that model of valuing consumer welfare, getting consumer value from healthcare facilities. I can then talk about what value would be created by the optimal allocation, and then I can compare it to the actual allocation.
It strikes me, Alan, that there might be a problem in attributing this to democratization here. It might just be that people with slightly different ideas about how to run a country come in, or it might have been something that would have happened anyway. Can we say that there is a causal effect of democratization on this change in healthcare?
So with the kind of techniques that I just mentioned, the answer is no, not directly. So what I do is I use another set of techniques to build on this previous model, demand side model of consumer value from healthcare, to start to get at the supply side drivers of where these healthcare facilities are allocated. So for example, what I do is I appeal to this technique in economics called revealed preference to say, if the government allocated healthcare in this way relative to that way, what kind of distortions can rationalize the fact that I see that they did something that the social maximizer would not have done? That is to say, I have a sense of, if you were just trying to maximize consumer value, where you would have put the healthcare facilities, I see that they didn't do that in reality. And so what is it that can rationalize that difference between the optimal and actual allocation? And by appealing to revealed preference, and in particular using frontier methods from the empirical IO literature called moment inequalities, I can then isolate the role of this Suharto-era patronage and these Suharto-era patronage networks in explaining why what I see in the data isn't what the value-maximizing social planner would have done.
Gusto's regime did not last more than a couple of years, but Indonesia's transition to democracy certainly did. Now, does Alan's work hint at something wider about the effect that democracy can have on infrastructure spending and its efficiency? And can we generalize from Indonesia's experience to the likely effect of democratization in other countries? There are two influences of democratization on how spending might be allocated. On the one hand, there is the responsiveness to the needs of the people. On the other hand, there are these local effects that might distort what happens. Did you find evidence for both of those effects?
Indeed, I do. I find both effects. On the one hand, these local elections can increase that accountability that disciplines public spending. And indeed, I find it to be the case that resources are no longer disproportionately directed towards Suharto supporters, for example. But there's this other effect too. On the other hand, these local elections are then going to increase politicians' focus on their own local constituents and kind of under-reward politicians for accounting for how other non-local Indonesians might benefit. And so both are at play. They're in opposition to each other. So there is a trade-off here.
And which direction does the trade-off go? Which effect is dominating here?
In the end, in my particular context, the accountability kind of benefits dominate.
Uh-huh.
And so what I find is that these local elections reduce misallocation overall. That is to say that they improve how this public spending is spent. And so, yes, in this case, democracy improves that efficiency of infrastructure spending.
Indonesia has changed a great deal in the last couple of decades. There has been all sorts of infrastructure spending, not just on healthcare. Can we say that this effect is also the case for other types of infrastructure spending? Did you look at that? Can we extrapolate the results at all?
In this paper, I just focus on healthcare infrastructure, which I should say is important and is a crucial part of improving welfare. But I do think that the framework that I bring to bear on this problem in this context is more broadly applicable. In the end, the key is that what my analysis focuses on really is durable infrastructure that's allocated by local governments. In that sense, the framework that I put together can be applied to other kinds of infrastructure like roads or schools. And indeed, I have another paper looking at a massive school construction program in Indonesia, emphasizing sort of other bits. But in principle, schools also, for example, are another thing that this framework could be applied to.
Also, I suppose when we're looking at the external validity of this, can we take it beyond Indonesia's borders? Can we say something bigger about the effect of democracy in this case? Because this was one very unusual institutional change at one moment in time in a country that had particular needs and particular constraints. So can we speculate from this that democracy is a force for good in disciplining policymakers who are spending on infrastructure, or is that stretching the result too far?
I think so. I think that I lay out a trade-off that's fairly fundamental and that can be applied broadly. That is to say that when you have local elections, you have this accountability, which can help. On the other hand, you're reinforcing what are ultimately these artificial local political boundaries that can hurt. And so there's this trade-off. The question of which force dominates is an empirical question, and the answer may differ in different contexts. I find accountability dominates in my particular context. But that said, I think it's also worth saying that this Indonesian case has a lot to teach us, especially in how it speaks to this transition out of a politically polarized strongman regime, which I think connects to some of the main issues facing democracies around the world in the modern era.
As you said, you do more work on this. This is also a framework that other people could take up and apply in those other contexts?
Absolutely.
Well, we look forward to finding out what the next tranche of research tells us. Alan, thank you very much for talking about your paper and the research that you've done.
Thank you, Tim.
This has been a Vox Dev Talk. We're delighted to be back for another year, and we've got a lot of great episodes featuring groundbreaking research for you in 2023. Now, the best way to make sure you don't miss anything is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, if you do miss an episode, you can always go to voxdev.org, where you'll find the podcast and articles about the papers we feature.